Turn on the lights. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon and welcome. I am Hanof Berenson, and I am a facility coordinator for the YU Medical Ethics Society. And I would like to invite everyone and welcome everyone to the 7th annual conference on medical ethics in contemporary halacha. And I would specifically like to invite everyone and welcome everybody to the first of the two breakout sessions with Dr. Pelkovitz, entitled, as we see here, Trauma and Resilience in the Second and Third Generation After the Holocaust. I would like to please, if everyone could take a minute or a moment to silence your phones or turn them off, preferably. Hopefully I remember to do that. Dr. Pelkovitz received his PhD from the University of Pennsylvania, and he holds the Gwendolyn and Joseph Strauss Chair in Psychology and Jewish Education at the Israeli Graduate School of Jewish Education and Administration here at Yeshiva University. Dr. Pelkovitz has written and co-written many books on the topics of parenting, personal growth, and on our communal responsibility as Jews. And so without further ado, I would like to introduce everyone to Dr. Pelkovitz.
Professional way that this whole conference has been run. We have till 2, so let's talk about the psychological component. It's interesting because this, what I was asked to speak about, is about the psychological fallout in the second and third generation. But the overall topic here is ethics. I'm going to try to also talk about implications of awareness of impact on ethical decision-making. So we're going to visit a little bit of the literature on what's known about second and third generation. We're also going to try to look at the thinking about, basically informed by the field of neuroethics, which I'll get into a little bit later, and sort of we'll play around with that a little bit. A scar without the wound is the way second generation and third generation children of Holocaust survivors have been described. The idea being that there's no obvious wound, there wasn't direct exposure, but yet, as anybody in this room who's themselves second or third generation, or anybody who has good friends who are second or third generation, or parents, or basically looking around the room, I know that that's basically this audience, right? Is people who I'm going to be talking about is your lived lives. And the question is how do we look at it, and what does it have to do with the topic of ethical decision-making. Now, here's what my understanding, as I try to pull together some of the research on this, has me come to some kind of a synthesis, is that there are two modes of communication. I grew up, by the way, just to give you a little bit of personal background, I was the only guy in my neighborhood who was not the child of survivors. My parents were American-born. I had four grandparents, all of whom were not all American born. Only one was American born, but the others, my friends, who were all second generation, I grew up in a community of survivors. And my friends used to come to my house to see what a grandparent looked like. I had grandparents. And they used to say, are you sure that's really your grandmother? She talks without an accent. What kind of a grandparent was that? Because one or two of them would have a grandparent. It was basically the community with that grandparent. And it's interesting, because the research tells us that now that we're understanding the role of grandparents, now that I'm a grandparent myself, I have a better appreciation of this, is that grandparenting plays a pretty crucial role. Even though we drive our children crazy by spoiling our grandchildren to death, and my kids try to stop me, I'll say, no, psychologically sound by saying yes to the fifth lollipop. I'll show you the articles. I make it a little longer. It's kind of why all my children are going into the mental health field. But I have this vivid memory, literally, first of all, myself being a little embarrassed that my parents did not have numbers on their arms, and also being very self-conscious that I was different from everybody else. Interestingly, in a number of situations, it's probably why I became a psychologist, my friends' parents would choose to tell me about their experiences in the camp, but never tell their children. I was a repository of many horrific stories because they couldn't bring themselves to talk to their kids because they just, they for understandable reasons, but they wanted somebody to bear witness. And that very much shaped my life. So these are the two extremes. The one extreme is the almost obsessive retelling, and growing up with that kind of background is certainly going to shape your world, even shape your ethical functioning in the world. You know, is it going to give you a mission to make sure that injustice is never done again? Or is it going to have an opposite effect in terms of feeling, I'm going to get away with whatever I can? Or the other extreme was an all-consuming silence, where it was a way of protecting the kids, but it, of course, made things much worse. Because anything, you all know it yourself, if you grew up in a home where there was a big secret kept from you, forget about Holocaust. Let's say there's a secret about something going on in your parents' life, and let's say there's an illness that people aren't talking about, marital problems, financial problems people aren't talking about. Whatever a kid imagines is underneath the unspoken pain is almost always going to be much worse than the reality. To name the monster is to conquer it. Something I've shared with some of you in the past is a fascinating experience I had with a colleague. I had a colleague, Bessel van der Kolk, one of the leading trauma experts in the world, actually. Often viewed as certainly in the top tier of post-traumatic stress disorder researchers. And we've collaborated together, written some papers together. Once he was in my office, we were working on a project, and he takes out of his briefcase the picture of a patient of his, of an fMRI, of the brain of a patient of his, who was stuck in the stairwell of the World Trade Center on 9/11. And he's showing me what does the brain look like at the moment that you're reliving the worst moment of your life. It turns out Broca's area is shut down, language centers of the brain are shut down, you're literally rendered speechless. Then what Dr. van der Kolk showed me in a series of other fMRIs, that as he lit up the language centers of the brain by giving his patient words for his pain, giving him meaning for his pain, giving him a way of going from dimut, right? Ba'id Aron, the Barbanel says, that it means that Aron, when he heard about the sudden death of his two sons, literally was struck silent in a very different way than Sheket would connote. It's literally being rendered speechless. But then what he shows me, as you light up the language centers of the brain, and you give people words for their pain, that's where healing comes in. And he just showed me. Literally, you could track it, and you could track the healing, and that's what we do by days like today with gaining awareness, because the eye sees only what the mind knows. So the all-consuming silence is not good, either extreme is not good. You have to find that golden middle ground where you respect the reality of what happened, but you put it in its place. Because in order to deal with any trauma, you have to go back and forth between naming the monster, but also having a Holocaust-free area of your life. You know, I had a very meaningful Shiva call about a year ago. It was a man I grew up with in that community I was telling you about. I didn't even know he was a survivor. He seemed more American than most. He didn't have an accent that I could tell. But I found out later that he suffered horribly in the war. Nobody thought he would live. He was liberated in early adolescence. And I go to meet Menachem Avil, his children, to pay a condolence call. And they call me to the side. Turned out that he died very suddenly, but after a long, wonderful life. And they take out pictures of the wedding he was at of a grandchild 2 weeks before his death. And they show me their two smiles. And they divide the pictures into two piles. One was the revenge on Hitler smile. And you saw it. It was a tight smile. It was a smile of victory, a look of triumph in his eyes, and also a look of almost like, we stuck it to these guys. Look at us. This huge, typical Orthodox Jewish wedding of 600 of their closest and dearest friends, right? And you just saw a mixture of pride and rage and vengeance and almost like transcendent. Then they showed me another set of pictures of bliss, of unbelievable bliss, a true smile. You know, there are ways that you could look at different kinds of smiles. And they said they grew up knowing the difference between what they called the vengeance smile and the real smile. And whenever they saw that other smile come on him, they knew, oh, he's having flashbacks. He's reliving what happened to him. And they knew, they were so tuned in. But yet, he didn't speak to them about it. It was all somehow transmitted nonverbally. And what was so nice is you saw as the generations went on and they were showing me these pictures, you saw their children, the third generation, sort of like benefiting from lighting up language centers in the brain. It's really a fascinating kind of experience. So what you want to go for is the middle between one and the other. So we already did all of this. So the patterns of impact, how does this play out in relationships in second and third generation, is on the connection end, it's sometimes one extreme, which is always known as an unhealthy extreme in family psychology, is enmeshed. You know, such closeness, you know, the mother would say, put on a sweater, I'm cold, you know. The other extreme of enmeshment is disengagement. It's sort of like a pulling back protectively because it's too scary to become too close. And then a real terror of letting kids go off to university, letting kids go off to sleepaway camp. I remember going to being in a dorm, a high school dorm. I went to a yeshiva high school that had a dorm in the high school. And there was a child of a survivor who, his parents had each had prior marriages. They had, if I remember correctly, 12 children, all of whom were killed by Hitler, and their spouse was killed by Hitler. And they met in the DP camp. It's not at all an uncommon story. They had one child. That was a guy I grew up with. And what was amazing was, they were totally triggered and traumatized by his going off to a dormitory high school. And they used to literally park outside of the school and come and bring him all kinds of pastries. He made a living by, I shouldn't say made a living, he had a fortune. He used to sell us, it was not good for me at all. He'd come with big boxes of pastries. And so my parents were just here. And he'd sell it at, like, if I remember correctly, it was 50 cents a pound or something. He made a fortune. It was the richest kid in school. But ultimately, he intermarried. This kid went to, I was talking to somebody here before, and because the only escape he had was to be able, he was drowning in their chicken soup. And the question is there a higher rate of intermarriage in this population? I don't know. I have to see if there's a literature on it. But when you have those extremes in somebody, by the way, here's the bottom line. The bottom line is that most second and third generation people are fine. The norm is resilience. The norm is that when you do empirical research on all of this, you find if you have the right kind of control group and you compare second and third generation people to second generation to first generation Americans, so it's a level playing field, there's no difference whatsoever. There's no, except that's in terms of disorder. What we're talking about here is the more invisible stuff. This famous psychiatrist, who's a trauma expert, Dr. Crystal, and he wrote about his experiences in the camps. And, let me develop this story because it's going to get to where I want to go. There was somebody in my neighborhood who won that year's award for the best book on a Jewish topic. It was called Against All Odds. It was about the resilience of survivors of camps. And they had a party to celebrate his getting the award. And one whole chapter in the book was about a man who was my neighbor who I was friendly with. And keeping up with my tradition growing up, he used to talk to me about some of his experience in the camps. His house is like 4 or 5 down from my house. And I'm in the house where they had the party, and I said to him, I read the book, I read the chapter about it. It's amazing because he was set up as a paradigm of resilience. So he calls me aside. He said, I gotta talk to you. He says, all of this is absolutely not true. He says, it's just not true. He says, yeah, it's true, I survived, it's true, you look at it, I have a beautiful house, and my children are extremely successful, and I have wonderful grandchildren. He says, you think the day goes by that when I hear a siren outside, I don't think it's the Gestapo coming? He said, my surviving was just plain dumb luck. And he then proceeds to tell me a story of one day he was in a typhus ward, and they used to have you stand sideways to see whether you had any profile whatsoever. If you had no profile, they thought, okay, we can't get any more work from you. So they'd send you to the line to go up to the gas chamber. So one day they'd say, okay, go to that area. And he was so weak from his illness that he collapsed on his bunk. And the bunk, by some miracle, broke. Because it must have been an unstable board. And the Gestapo guard starts beating him senseless, saying, disgusting Jew, you're trying to rob the Reich of your work. He says, you fat slob, look what you've done. You're so fat, you broke the bed. And he schleps him into the healthy barracks, where they hide him for 3-4 months, or however long it is, till he gets his strength back. And then he proceeds to tell him story after story after story, where he says, there's nothing special about me. I was no different than anybody else. There's nothing resilient about me. He says, sure, I may look resilient. And what he's basically saying is what Dr. Crystal said. Dr. Crystal was interviewed about this book. And he said, let me tell you about this, the problem with this book. And it was a wonderful book. I'm not criticizing it at all. He's saying, it's true. You know, you look whether or not I have a DSM-4 diagnosis, psychiatric diagnosis, I don't. He said, I am resilient. I'm a successful psychiatrist and author and et cetera, et cetera. He said, but you know something? I have not slept for a full night since basically 1939. He said, I'm plagued by constant flashbacks and constant kinds of hyper alertness and avoidance of any kind of trigger. He says, there's a big difference between being psychologically free of disorder and even resilient and the invisible wounds that are hard to see. Okay, this is depressing. This is depressing. We're going to talk about resilience, okay? And maybe we'll get a discussion going here. I'll tell you the story of the chronic neck tick, which is an interesting second generation story. And I was a speaker at a conference on post-traumatic stress disorder. And the other speaker was a well-known psychiatrist, and he told the audience the following story. He said there was a man who had it's called a chronic motor tic. He would turn like this constantly. But sometimes people, for neurologic reasons, get a chronic motor tic. And it was extremely painful. And he had a $1 million workup with a leading neurologist and orthopedist. They couldn't figure out what it was. It didn't present quite like a typical chronic motor tic would go. And he was in excruciating pain. And when all else fails and you can't find a physical reason for something, they refer you to a psychiatrist. So the psychiatrist, who is the other speaker on this panel, says the following. He says, he tells the audience, he sees the guy, and does the full mental health evaluation on him, and he's normal. He says, what is it, there are two kinds of people, there are normal people and people I know. Every once in a while, you come across a normal person. He says, you're the guy, you're tough, no problems whatsoever, I can tell you, well-adjusted, you're terrific. He said, but there's one thing that I'd like to understand about your history. It probably says nothing about your chronic motor tic, but you tell me your father is a survivor. He's living in a nursing home in Florida, where else? And go and ask him. He never talked to you about his experience in the camps. Maybe you should go and ask him. Maybe it'll shed some light on this. So he says, fine. And he flies to Florida, visits his dad, and tells him, I have this weird motor tic. And it's very painful. My doctor doesn't think it's tied to anything, but he wants me to talk to you. For some weird reason, he thinks you might have some insight on it. And immediately, his father starts to cry. And he says, I thought I could shelter you from this. He said, I never told you that I was married, before I was married to your mother, I was married to another woman, and you have 6 siblings, I never told you that. You have a number of siblings, I forget the exact number. You have a number of half-brothers and half-sisters. And we were in the gathering place at whatever camp it was, and my wife and children were being led off to the left. And the last time I saw them, I was straining to see them, looking back at them, when the capo came over to me and beat me unconscious. When I woke up in the camp, I realized I'll never see them again. Now that's an unbelievable story. How's that transmitted? By the way, the man came back, talked to his psychiatrist about this story. They gave words to it. They lit up the language center. They went from the minutes, from the total silence of trauma and pain and speechlessness, to naming the monster. And guess what? The tip went away. The power of naming the pain, the power of bringing words to our pain. That's by way, but how is it transmitted? I have no idea. There are a lot of theories. I spoke to, there are actually specialists in the post-traumatic stress disorder field who specialize in the way the body's, a friend of mine who wrote an article about this, called it, the body keeps the score. Your body keeps the score. And it's different ways that things are transmitted. I truly don't get it. It sounds like almost mystical to me. But it's a very powerful story, not the only one of its kind. Okay? Here's a story, and I guess I'll frame the question of the next part of the talk with this story. This happened to me by some weird chance on the same Shabbos. Totally unrelated. I'm a scholar in residence at a shul in Beverly Hills. And I'm talking to some older man, very, very sweet, lovable man. We're just talking, he has an accent. And he starts talking to me about, I don't know how this happens to me, but he starts talking to me about his experiences in the camps. Beverly Hills has a large community of survivors. I see some second and third generation people here who come from that community. Tells me, I asked him, so what was your, I know it sounds a little corny, but we're told, Ma'at min ha'or, built the harbe min ha'kosha. little sparks of light push away a great deal of darkness. So I asked him, what was your spark of light? What got you through it? And he smiles and tears come to his eyes. And he says, I'll tell you, it's a funny thing. He said, my father used to bench me. He used to bless me every Friday night. And there was a special moment we had once a week on Friday night. He said, where I feel his hands on my head and the warmth of his breath just sort of embracing my face. And he said, throughout my time in the camps, when horrible things were happening, the Germans would come in at 3, 4 in the morning and start cursing at us and chasing us out into the freezing cold, and we were going through horrific times. He said, I kept imagining and feeling my father's breath on my head and his hands embracing me and that hug that he gave me Friday night. He said, it's the Friday night bracha that got me through. That's the conversation I had right after I gave the talk towards the end of Shabbos. That night, I had to give a talk in a different part of town, and there was some other survivor there. And he comes over to me, I don't even remember what triggered this, and he's, just by chance, he says, you know what the worst time of the week for me is? He says, it's when I see my son and daughter-in-law benching the kids, because I think that was robbed from me. That was stolen from me. I never had that. I was very young when I was sent off to the concentration camps. And I think, okay, it's nice my grandchildren had it. Why couldn't I have that? And he's like, he's just angry. Just angry. And the question is, how do you, first of all, understand both totally different ways of viewing a Friday night bracha? What does that say about resilience? That's like what research shows. Research shows that those who, after 9/11, did not focus on vengeance and anger, I mean directly impacted, who lost direct family members, did very differently in terms of the trajectory of their healing than those who, after 9/11, focused on gratitude for what they had and focused on doing acts of kindness for others and on connecting to others in a way that saw life happily. And it's a very powerful finding that virtually any study on resilience in the face of horrible trauma shows that there's a certain choice people have. You have every right to be angry, and who am I or anybody to question somebody who's gone through the horrors of the Holocaust to be angry and to hold on to the anger. But ultimately, at a certain point, there's a way that approach and pulls you in to a place that's not necessarily very good for you, as opposed to the ability to focus on what he had versus what he didn't have with the first Friday night. Okay? Now, because this has been very heavy, I'm going to go to something else, and I'm going to tie it to all of this, and we're fine with time. I'm going to start with this story, because now we're going to go to talking about ethics. Listen to this story. It's a patient of mine who I saw after 9/11, and he told me the following unbelievable story. This was not made public at the time, probably, thankfully, but he told me that he was working in one of the towers of the World Trade Center on that horrible Tuesday morning. And he found himself in the underground concourse with hundreds and hundreds of people. And there were a bunch of uniformed policemen and firemen telling everybody there were steps leading to safety, but there was falling debris. This must have been just in the minutes before the tower collapsed. And the policemen were telling everybody, just stay here, this is the safest place to be. It's a concourse. This is a very strong building. You have nothing to worry about. You go outside, you're taking your life in your hand. And he told me, everybody listened. He said there were hundreds and hundreds of people there. Everybody listened, but it was a totally open staircase. And a policeman blocking the staircase to make sure that nobody would escape, you know, to go to their certain deaths, they would say. And he told me, he said, you know, he said, it was his grandmother. My grandmother was a survivor. When she raised me to never trust anybody anymore. She raised me to never blindly listen to authority figures. He says, everybody was just listening to the police. He said, me and about 40 other people, because I'm convinced every one of them is either second or third generation, charged the steps, pushed the cop away, run. He then walked over the bridge, walked home, comes home, leads to a whole bunch of other stories about the coming weeks for him. But he attributes his surviving that day to being a third generation person. So the question becomes very interesting. From an ethical standpoint, he looked at authority in a totally different way. And I'm sure many people here who are second and third generation know exactly what I'm talking about. Often raised to have a healthy disrespect for authority, you have to also get you into some pretty interesting kinds of moral dilemmas that might get you into trouble. It cuts both ways. So I'm going to take a minute to just go over for you the basics of neuroethics, with apologies for those of you who know this, and I'm going to start by showing you what's called the switch dilemma and the footbridge dilemma. So here's the switch dilemma. Switch dilemma is a train is hurtling at high speed to go on this track where, with beyond the shadow of a doubt, he's going to kill these five railroad workers. You find yourself standing at this switch that controls the trajectory of the train. If you flip the switch, the train will go onto this other track. And this man who otherwise would have lived will be killed, but these five will live. How many of you will flip the switch? Okay, good. How many of you would absolutely not flip the switch? Okay, well, that's about right. By the way, typically in the Yeshiva University audience, there are men who raise they wouldn't. Raise their hand saying they wouldn't for a variety of reasons, including possibly halakhic reasons. But it's interesting. In a general audience, most people, their answer is that they would not flip the switch. I think over 80% of the people asked this question say they won't. Okay? By the way, it'd be interesting to do a study to see how second and third generation people would answer this. But it seems like there's a strong consensus in this room not that you would flip the switch. Now, here's a slightly different scenario. It's called a footbridge dilemma. You have a really big guy up here. He's a railroad worker, and he has an equipment pack on that makes him, adds to his bulk even more weight. And the train is hurtling towards these five workers. You know, if you jump on the tracks heroically, you're just too thin to be able to do anything. It'll run over, it'll kill all six of you. But if you push him off, okay, you will stop the train and save five lives. How many of you would push the man off? See, it's fascinating. I'm not going to give you a chance to think too much. Nobody raised their hand. A strikingly different answer than to the first answer, even though from a quantitative standpoint, it's an identical moral dilemma. Now, what am I saying? What does neuroethics tell us? Neuroethics tells us the following. Neuroethics tells us that when I asked you question number one, the switch dilemma, the part of your brain that lit up was this area towards the front of the brain, dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. For the men here, it's where you put your shell roche on every morning and fill in, okay? It's exactly why, it's where judgment lives, it's where control lives, it's where it lives, and it's immediate. It's rational. It's the rational decision-making part of our brain. It's the moral knowledge. You know, it just makes sense. You think about things totally stripped of emotion, of course you're going to flip the switch because you're going to have four people walking the earth a little more worth otherwise. It's clear, straight thinking. I'm not saying it's right. It's an incredibly complex moral question. The part of the brain that lit up, that led to nobody raising their hand to question two, is right here. This is exactly the part of it, deep in the emotional part of the brain. You see the part that's lit up over here. And it turns out that emotions come into it. Nobody raised their hand because it's emotionally so different to physically push somebody on. I have a friend whose father was in Auschwitz. He was, I think it was Auschwitz, Elie Wiesel's bunkmate, one of his bunkmates. Turns out for some weird reason, a famous picture of Elie Wiesel, my life is taking me on a course that I got to know a lot of people in that picture. And I grew up with one of the guys next to Elie Wiesel. And he used to talk to me and not to his kids. And he told me, you know what the key was to my surviving? He says, five times I was selected to be sent to the gas chambers and the adolescent barracks. He says, the first time, I pretended that I hurt my leg. And I turned to the Gestapo guy, to the guy who was taking us off to the gas chambers, and I said, look, I'm happy to come, but I can't do it. I just can't do it. You carry me. And the guy just ignored him because he made contact. He had become the man on the footbridge. Each time that he was selected to go into the gas chamber, he somehow connected in some way that made him the man on the footbridge. And they couldn't do it. They could only do it when you were nameless and faceless and not an appealing, good-looking, cute 13-year-old boy or 14-year-old boy. You know, that's at least the way I understood it back when he used to tell me these stories. Never his son. Actually, one day should find his son and tell him all these stories. I don't even know if he knows them. So, it turns out that where I'm going with this is the idea that when emotions dominate in ethical decision making, there tends to be something called ethical fading. We think in a totally different way. We see the trees, not the forest. We act out of self-interest. And the argument I have is, my guess is, if we did good empirical research on role decision making in second and third generation, we find the same split that I talked about earlier. Those who have named the monsters, those who have been able to talk about the meaning of their parents' and grandparents' history, my guess is, will be in some ways highly moral and ethical people. Better than most because of being, and I know many people like that, I know many survivors like that, and it's often a source of resilience. But people who go through life without visiting and processing the meaning of the invisible scar, that will not happen. Let me end, and then I want to have some time for questions and comments. I'm going to end with the Dubna Magid Mashal of the Flaw in the Jewel. One of my favorite pieces of imagery for dealing with the horror of what you've been hearing about all day. And it's a famous Dumna parable that helped get a lot of Jews through tough times back when he was giving these talks. So here's what he said. He said there was a king who had a crown that had at the center of the crown a diamond that was bigger than the Hope diamond. And he was an insecure king. He got an unbelievable amount of pleasure from having the biggest and the best in the land. And he'd wake up every morning, look at this huge diamond, and say, wow, I'm really something, and he'd put it on, and he'd be proud. One morning, he wakes up, and he sees that a flaw has developed right down the center of the diamond, and he is spooked. Sees him as a very bad omen. He puts out a call to his kingdom that anybody who comes and fixes this diamond, he will make wealthier beyond his wildest dreams. So people come from all over the world. Jewelers, the leading jewelers, they try to fix the flaw in the diamond. We all know, you can't fix the flaw in the diamond. The flaw in the diamond cannot be fixed. It never be fixed. A permanent flaw. Till a little old Jew comes in. This has to be a Jewish hero here. A little old Jewish man comes in, picks up the diamond, takes an engraving tool, and engraves magnificent leaves around the floor that now becomes the trunk of a tree that makes the diamond even more beautiful than it was before. And that's, I think, the bottom line lesson. We all know there's a famous Medrash Tehillim that says, Ilu nafalti lo kamti, ilu yashavti b'choshech lo hayarli. If I never fell down, I never would have gotten up. If I never dwelled in the darkness, I never would have appreciated the light. Second generation and third generation children and then later adults have the benefit of what we call vicarious growth, post-traumatic growth. You can't undo the flaw. Your history is your history. But what you can do is you can engrave magnificent leaves around it to make it into something that is even more magnificent than you'd be without that flaw in the diamond. It's still a diamond, but it's a flawed diamond. But flaws are often an engine of growth. Flaws often lead to a wisdom of knowing what's important in the world, what's not important in the world. Knowing the importance of doing chesed, knowing the beauty of staying connected to family, to friends, to faith. So that's my final take on message, hopefully a little bit positive. And let me hear any questions or thoughts. Yes, please.
Thank you. I think this is
Thank you.
I think this is an Ashkenazi audience. In general, Ashkenazim name their children after the departed, and that always, I think, I'm not a psychologist, but I think it leads for the named person to try to live up to the attributes that are told of the namesake. When one is from a survivor home, I would think that the mythologizing of the kadosh that the particular child is named after may exponentiate this. My question to you is, because you did mention overachieving, but you put it in a different part of your talk. You didn't put it in the very beginning. You mentioned about the problems that survivors, the kids, with survivors' kids. You didn't speak about the overachievers that you grew up with.
And the overachievers.
That was very intriguing.
Yeah, thanks so much for raising that, because it's really a terrific point.
And overachieving is a psychology term. I don't subscribe.
Right. By the way, and
nobody here prescribes to that.
And certainly right. No second generation or third generation person would. That would be a dirty word in such a home. And I'm very much inclined to agree. And I actually meant to make the point. I remember when I was reviewing my slides, I meant to make the point that that almost everything there has a positive component. It could become the tree or it could become the flaw. And overachieving is a perfect example. I think back to all the kids I grew up with. I'm 61 years old, so it's that kind of community. And I think back, okay, what happened to everybody? They've outstripped my career by leaps and bounds, okay? These are people who all, and that you can't overachieve, you could only reach your potential. So some of them have become profoundly wealthy business people. Others have become, unbelievably sought after physicians. They're names that we'd recognize. We all know that, the level of success is often astounding, okay? And that's wonderful. I don't know what the happiness levels would be necessarily, but that often leads to increased happiness and fulfillment in life. So yeah, thank you for raising that. And by the way, the whole issue of naming somebody and what that means is extremely powerful. I have a story that maybe I'll tell to the next group that's you just triggered in my head about the naming, and I'm going to make sure at the next talk, the 2:10 talk, you have time, but we also have questions. Let me see. You know what? If there is time, I'll tell that story, but it's not such a happy story. So it was about the power of naming, unless I could think of an optimistic naming story. Maybe I'll make something up. Let's see. Thank you. Yeah, please.
I actually have something to say about overachieving.
Yes.
I'm a first-generation survivor. My parents were.
Second generation, right.
Houses, and they were being benched, and and I was so devastated. Like, the anger was just, it was like a rage, because I never got benched. And I just felt like that wasn't, you know.
And why weren't you benched?
No grandparent. My father left when I was born because he had a wife and four kids, and Ash was killed. So where I was born, he pretty much took off. And so I remember feeling like, why can't I be benched? And it would put me into such a rage. And I still have that rage till this day.
Wow. So notes, you're saying your very existence was a trigger for him, because it reminded him of his other children, and existence he couldn't live with. Because it was a trigger. Wow. That's so powerful.
The rage was absolutely terrible. And I didn't know how to take that rage. I still have it. Or I have dreams where they say, you were supposed to have been killed in the Holocaust. Why are you still alive? Like, it's so...
So powerful. And, wow.
And also in terms of overachievers, my brother and sister are tremendous overachievers. One's a big, famous psychologist, who I don't care. And the other one is... And I was not an overachiever. And they are arrogant. They use their success. It's not like the flaw where they've been raving. They actually use their success to show that they're better than other people. And
wow.
It's a twist. And so in our family, there was a huge, unfortunately, it was a darkness.
Can I ask you something? Because what you're saying is so important. When do you find? Are there any times that you're able to find yourself connecting to somebody being benched, or connecting to your extended family in a way that you could move from the anger to the next step? Like, what would be associated with the ability to move to the next step? Right. So when you see, sort of similar to the victory smile or the vengeance smile of my opening story, that would do it. Yeah. Thank you. That's very helpful. Yes, in the back.
You know, our second generation kids had an overarching desire never to aggravate their parents. We did not want to bring them amongst my friends. So we became very independent, self-reliant, and all that sort of thing. We just did not want to bother them and give them any further pain. And I'm just wondering, as a parent and a grandparent, is that such a terrible thing?
You mean, is it a terrible thing to not want to...
Not to give out my snappish to your parent, because after all, it came out of a gross...
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I'm so glad you asked that, because I like the clapping. God forbid that anybody should leave here thinking that I'm pathologizing this. And that was the point you made also.
Yes.
I don't want to, and I realize that I may have left that impression, because that's what psychologists do for a living. But the reality is that, God forbid, if anything, the message I wanted to convey was that much... In many situations, the flaw turns into the tree that makes the diamond even more beautiful than it was before. And that in many situations, it becomes a source of success and a deeper life and a more fully lived and appreciated life. So yeah, thanks for saying, no, absolutely not. Not learning not to give your kids Agmas Nevesh. Again, it would set at an extreme. And because of that, you have to sit on a lot of stuff and it's hurting. And it's at a great emotional cost, and of course it's a problem. But it's often, so you become experts at kibbutzim. What kibbutzav? What could be better than that? Absolutely. Now I'm glad you said that. So, okay, yes, yeah.
There are a lot of people that not necessarily descendants of survivors that have a very strong connection to the Holocaust, whether it's, you know, wanting to continue to read more and more about stories or feel, even I've heard people who feel as if they're a reincarnation of, you know, someone who is there. Where does that deep connection come from? It's not necessarily from a second or third generation.
You mean somebody who's not a second generation?
Yeah.
Yeah. that comes from, I think, part of Jewish identity today. I mean, certainly the case in anybody in this room, anybody who came to this who's not second or third generation. Some of us were born shortly after or born during what was one of the most seminal historic events in Jewish history. And I think that, and we're born so close to it that we've been able to witness, we know here from the Names Not Numbers founder, the power of being able to connect and directly bear witness to what happened, and growing up surrounded by it, and especially with Yom HaShoah programs and all of that, so be able to connect to it in that kind of way, I think it has to be part of our cultural DNA. As part of a healthy Jewish identity, how could you not name a mantra? Let me end with this. I'm going to end with a beautiful thought from Rabbi Ruchem Lubavitz. That's, I think, an okay way to end. Ruchem Lubavitz, who was the Mashgiach of the Mir in pre-Holocaust Europe, he asked an obvious question. In a very, very hard-to-understand passage in Mehu Mishpatim, it describes God's footstool. And it says, God's footstool was Kamaseh Libnasa Sapphire, meaning that it was sapphire, and embedded in the sapphire was a brick. And it says the brick was a reminder of the suffering of the Jews in Egypt. Interesting imagery. So, with Lubavitz, who literally was living just before everything really happened, but saw it coming, he says, Ma inyan shibud l'achar ha'gula. He says, why? That makes no sense. Why would there be need to put in some kind of permanent, eternal state, reminders of suffering? Common sense, he says, would say that when you go through a tough time and now you're past it, either as a people or as an individual, forget about it, let it go, move on, get into your new life, go to Israel, rebuild. And he says it's to teach us that the obligation of every Jew is when you're going through a tough time, and now you're past it, and you've emerged victorious, and it happened years ago, where you may even have children, but you say, why should I burden them with knowledge of this tough time? He says, you know something? You have to integrate the lesson of the brick into the light of the sapphire. That's what we have to do. That's our imperative. It's imperative of everybody here, who's second generation, third generation, or beyond. You have to integrate, because it's the lesson of the brick that informs our life and deepens our lives. That's what today is about. That's what today's session was about. And thank you, everybody, for coming.
Thank you, Dr. Pelkovitz. We have a 10-minute break, and then the next sessions will start.
Go ahead. Good question.